Welcome to Nature Revisited, the podcast. For those of you who are new to the podcast, my name is Stefan Van Norden, and thank you for joining me. On today's episode, we are joined by Douglas Chadwick and the Wolverine. Douglas is a wildlife biologist who has studied mountain goats, grizzly bears, elephants, and whales. He is the author of some 10 books and the vice chair of the board for Vital Ground. In 2002, Douglas joined the Glacier Wolverine Project to study the wolverine, which resulted in him writing the book, The Wolverine Way. Douglas joins me today by phone from his home in Western Montana to discuss the reputation and attitude of this amazing animal, whose reality is so much more complex than the legends and the myths that surround them. So Douglas, welcome to Nature Revisited. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast to talk about the life and fate of one of the most elusive animals, the wolverine. Let's start with, when did you first become interested in the wolverine, and how much did you know about the wolverine, or the gulo, before joining the Glacier Wolverine Project?
I was studying mountain goats. I was looking for those white cliff climbers we know as mountain goats. I would set up tents in remote valleys and go up and try to find the goats and get a population survey done. And coming back, my tent was torn up. My sleeping bag inside was just a heap of feathers. In the middle of it all was a nice big poop left by a wolverine. And once in a while, both in the wilderness there and in Glacier Park, where I also studied mountain goats in the high country, I would very occasionally, see a wolverine. So what I knew about them was wolverines walk across these vast mountain slopes. They lope, they ramble, they never stop. They disappear over a ridge, and then they're gone. So that was the extent of my knowledge. When a friend and colleague, another biologist who worked in the park, said, we need to know more about natural history of these animals. No one really has much of an idea about that. And we're going to set up camps in the backcountry of Glacier, stay in ranger cabins, work mostly in the winter, and get some radios on these animals so we can follow them and learn about their daily lives, because they got some real challenges to survival, and their numbers are quite low in the lower 48 states. You want to come along? And I said, sure. One of the first times out, they showed me a towering peak that a wolverine had climbed in the middle of winter for reasons known only to the wolverine. One of the other times I first went out with the crew, I saw two kits, as the young are called, playing with their mother. This is a wonderful animal. Who knew? And it just kept going from there.
So when was the Glacier Wolverine Project first started, and how long did it last?
Around 2002, it lasted through 2006. Eased a little bit into 2007. I joined up pretty close to the start, and for 5 years in between my other work, which was mostly assignments for National Geographic, I'd come back, stay in a cabin for days or weeks at a time, monitoring these big box traps we had set up to try to capture wolverines, tag them with radios, and then go out and track them. What does that mean? You can't keep up with a wolverine. They go straight up an icy chute, 1,500 feet in 15 minutes. In the middle of winter, there's a blizzard howling. you can't keep up with these critters. But we did the best we could, and I did that day after day, and it just got more and more addictive because these critters turned out to be the wildest of the wild that I had ever encountered.
So who are some of the other scientists and researchers involved with you on the Glacier Wolverine Project?
Well, one was Jeff Copeland, who worked with the U.S. Forest Service Research Station associated with the University of Montana. He sort of oversaw the project. And he had worked with wolverines before in the central Idaho wilderness. He knew how to go about capturing and tracking these animals. The head of the field study was Ricky Yates, a biologist who had studied eagles and then other carnivores in Glacier National Park, who I knew personally. Then we had an assortment of other volunteers like myself, and they included a veterinarian, and he lived to get out in the wilderness. We could call him up in the middle of the night and say, we've got to trap wolverine, and he'd show up in the middle of the night after skiing in 7 miles and halfway up a mountain. And then there was a guy who owned a large equipment operation. He lived to get up there, stay in a little cabin, ski his heart out, and just be around these wild creatures. They fascinated him. It was a small group of people, but every one of them was sort of extraordinary because the rule was no whiting in wolverine camp. Didn't matter how far we had to go, how tough the weather was. And what can I say? They all loved the wild. They loved the wilderness. And they were resourceful, independent people.
So how difficult was it to collect the information about the wolverine?
What we discovered using radios, and, you know, none of us liked sedating a truly wild animal that kind of symbolized the freedom of the mountains and handling it and subjecting it to human needs. But, say, wolverines were not doing well outside parks and preserves. In fact, there were 300 or fewer left south of Canada, whereas they used to be found in California, Arizona, or New Mexico. We needed to know more about them, and in a hurry. What we discovered by finally getting enough radios on these very rare animals was how far and how often they move. This is an on-the-go creature, constantly, not only during the day, but portions of the night, all seasons. Wolverines were subject to trapping, and that was really what took them down. By the 1920s, the wolverine population south of Canada had been actually made extinct. They were gone. And they came back from Canada after predator poisons were widely banned during the 60s and 70s. Then game departments would once again established trapping seasons for the animals. And the question was, how many are there? And they would send out a biologist who would go across the terrain, and every time he or she crossed a track, record it, and this would be a sort of census of wolverines. And they'd come back and say, well, I found tracks in most every valley and mountainside I went across. We got radios on wolverines, and we found the same thing, with the exception that that was one wolverine. All those tracks were left by one animal. That's how huge their territories are. They defend those territories. If it's a male wolverine, there may be one or two females sharing that territory, but no other males. This is a very widely dispersed, thinly distributed species. In the entire million-plus acres of soaring topography in Glacier National Park, there probably is only room for about 35 wolverines. And that's the best, densest population in the lower 48 states left.
So you say in the book, there is wildness, and then there is Wolverine wildness.
Well, Wolverines add to that naturally. Wolverines were originally distributed across northern North America and across northern Europe. So the tales about Wolverines go way back, and they're almost uniformly about a thoroughly savage, vile-smelling, perpetually ticked-off species that is too surly to even get along with one another, will eat their young if they find it. And it was one demeaning projection of something in human nature onto Wolverine. What it springs from, I think, is that they, for a small package, now remember, we're talking about an animal that's 3 feet long and maybe four if you count the tail, that will try to back off animals like a several hundred pound grizzly bear, a cougar, or a pack of wolves from a carcass. Because the wolverine is not just a hunter, it's a scavenger. In fact, it's primarily a scavenger. Part of that involves a roar like a chainsaw and a Harley Davidson revving up together. But it also requires tons of attitude. These guys just don't back down. They have good claws. They have strong jaws. They're very agile. They often succeed in backing down other creatures. That's an important part of their lifestyle. The wolverine's attitude gave it this ferocious reputation. I think it came mostly from people who were killing them for a living. They were trapping them. And if you meet a wolverine caught in a set of steel jaws, you're going to have something like a Tasmanian devil on crack. Or if you corner one in a cabin, found a wolverine had chewed its way inside seeking the food it smelled, and you corner it, yeah, you're going to meet that wolverine. They were said to be a terrific danger to people because of this ferociousness and this violent temper. That was the image they had. We found wolverines to be an animal that, like other animals, cared for us young, had a family structure, cavorted down snowfields, played a lot with each other when they're young. It was just an animal. It was not something we feared or hoped it to be. It just happened to be extra tough.
So what is the Wolverine Pledge?
Can I read it to you?
Sure.
I'm talking about being out in the woods, surrounded by the mountains of Glacier Park, and I wrote, "The crags all around are beyond monumental. I'm a moat beneath them. They have endured for eons on end. My existence, by comparison, seems a passing glimmer, like the ring of ripples on a lake from the rise of the trout. The lesson from nature this grand, I would tell myself, is to at least have the grace to be humble." Then I started following wolverines around. They are smaller than I. Their lifespan is considerably shorter, yet whatever they do undaunted. They live life as fiercely and relentlessly as it has ever been lived. If wolverines have a strategy, it's this: go hard and high and steep and never back down, not even from the biggest grizzly and least of all from a mountain. Climb everything, trees, cliffs, avalanche chutes, summits, eat everybody, alive, dead, long dead, moose, mouse, fox, frog, its still warm heart, or frozen bones.
So there are lots of things, as you say, we do not know about the wolverine. But can you share with us some of the things that we do know, such as their habitats, their territories, their mating habits, and their numbers?
Their numbers are forever guesswork because of that large territorial need I talked about. Several hundred square miles of defended, rugged, remote country. They are hard to find in the first place, extremely hard to count. We found the densest population in the lower 48, and it didn't have very many animals. As soon as you go outside that park boundary, wolverine populations drop off the face of the earth. And that's because of human disturbances, access, and trapping in the backcountry. Why are they so vulnerable? It's because a wolverine female produces kits, 1 to 4, usually about 2, and not necessarily every year, and not before they reach at least 3 years of age. Half of the young they produce, 1 out of 2, 50%, usually disappear in the first year. From avalanches, larger carnivores, wolves, bears, cougars, contests over carcasses. They live about 13 years. A male's enormous territory may include a couple of females, where it used to be said that they got together only to breed because of their, hair trigger temperament. We found males and females traveling together, regularly together. They had some sort of social bond. By the way, females den in the winter under 8 to 10 feet of snow. They don't hibernate. Mom will go off hunting to bring back food for her young after nursing them. Rather than finding males as a terrible threat to the young, we found males sometimes with the female and young, so we're assuming it was the father, and staying there. They may have been bringing food themselves, but staying there to help defend those kits. What we found was that, yes, the young became fairly independent at about 6 months, but they still would come back and rejoin their mom. And, big surprise, sometimes their dad, and travel with them for a while. And they were allowed to stay in their parents' territories for up to 2 years, which is when they reached maturity. So it was a whole different view of these creatures. When I talk about them backing off grizzly bear, say, over a carcass, this is an animal that's not just 3 feet long, but weighs maybe 25 to 40 pounds, taking on a bear that weighs several hundred pounds. They are scattered across the states of Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington in small enclaves here and there. An entire mountain range might hold 8 wolverines. This is really an unusual pattern. Standard ways of going in and helping protect the species just don't quite apply. And that makes the wolverine kind of indicator species of how we should think about protecting nature. Small, isolated reserves here and there can work, but they don't hold up over time because environments are always changing. The wolverines have big snowshoe feet and walk on their heels, so the whole foot helps spread out their weight on a surface. They can kind of skipple across snow that other animals are post-homing through. This gives them a real competitive advantage over other carnivores competing for prey. It also helps them become better predators. And so they dominate the area they live, but that's the high country. That's the alpine and subalpine zones. There's not a lot of food per square mile up there. And so the wolverines' thin distribution, their territorial system, is what keeps them spread out in densities that fit the low productivity of those high country environments. For them, the high country is a big refrigerator where they can stash some extra food. They'll put it in boulder fields with ice-cold meltwater running underneath them. They're a climate change critter. They're a very good indicator. The high country environments change and winters become warmer. This species, which arose during the ice ages and has been tied to environments that are cool year-round, have deep lingering snowpacks, they're going to be up against it. If nothing else, the wolverine sends these messages about large landscapes and climate change that we should at least be paying attention to. It's gone from an animal that hardly anyone knew much about and the media never paid attention to. Suddenly, it's in the headlines as a species newly declared threatened by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. People are paying attention to it, and because of that, they're paying attention to some crucial environmental issues in a fresh way.
So during your research in the Glacier National Park, was there one wolverine that kind of stood out amongst the rest?
There was. There was indeed. We called him M3, not a very creative name, for an animal that was just beyond tusk and was a badass's badass. This was a young animal we knew as a juvenile, and as he matured, he started kicking out older male wolverines from their territories and taking them over. He was building himself quite an empire, and it extended not only through a large portion of Glacier National Park, but on up into the Canadian Rockies. The data from his radio included GPS locations. We could put them on a map and chart not only where M3 was, but how quickly he was moving, because there was a time stamp to go with it. The tallest mountain in Glacier Park is Mount Cleveland. It's 10,400 feet close to the Canadian border. And what we noticed as we downloaded the data onto a computer, this guy started off way over on one side of the park, moved across to the base of Mount Cleveland, kind of wandered around in a bowl towards the base of the mountain. And then he went up nearly a mile of vertical terrain, straight up to the very tip-top of Mount Cleveland. And he did that in 90 minutes. And you realize that mountaineering feats like this are just a normal day for a wolverine. I mean, we saw them do similar things elsewhere. And we wondered why. But one thing that occurred to me is you get up to the tip top of a mountain and you have a sense of smell as keen as the wolverines, which makes us living largely as scavenger. The winds are stronger. They're coming from this huge landscape. And you're maybe just doing a survey of where's an interesting scent coming from and where will I go next? And the other way to look at it is maybe the wolverine just wants to get to someplace beyond that mountain. And the fact that there is this massive thing with a lot of vertical, risky terrain in the way, may not necessarily bother an animal with an extra large heart and extra large lungs. This gives them a nearly boundless supply of strength and endurance. So maybe it's just not a big deal to go climb a mountain to get to the next spot you want to go.
During your research, did you experience a spiritual connection to the wolverine, an animal that many indigenous people would sometimes refer to as the creator, a brother, or even a trickster?
Yes. When I talked about living life as fiercely and relentlessly as there's ever been lived, and when you are discovering new things about an animal that does that, you're doing it a bit too. Fiercely relentless does not describe me, but keeping up with wolverines drew upon what you had inside you. And at the same time, you found yourself admiring a beast that took on the scale of these mountains. I should say before I forget, the trickster part and part of the calumny heaped on wolverines by early nature writers came from the fact that Native Americans set their own versions of traps for animals. Europeans, and then, of course, the frontier of Americans, they were all trapping wolverines. At the same time, they were trapping a lot of other animals, and wolverines, being the scavengers they are, some of them made a pretty good living eating the animals of other species that were caught in traps. And that really ticked off the trappers. And I think it ticked off the Indians. And I think the Indians experienced what I did when I talked about finding my tent torn open and a sleeping bag that I really needed in the middle of winter reduced to feathers. So that's the trickster part. Wolverines, through their toughness and endurance, were truly inspiring in every way I had imagined, and I didn't know how to imagine just how big that could be.
We need to have a sense of wildness ourselves. How does that wolverine speak to that sense of wildness? And why is that so important to us?
That's a great question. And we came from wildness, Stefan. The primate line arose millions of years ago. Homo sapiens is thought to have arisen about 350,000 years ago. For 99.99% of our existence on the planet, there wouldn't have been a word for wildness or wild because everything was wild. That's who we are, how we came to be. Wolverines take me back into the wild. I greatly fear a day coming when, between all our technology and artificial intelligence and who knows what's next, every place we go and all we think about and everything we see is shaped by other humans. And yet we came from a whole different environment. Wolverines just put the wildness right in front of you and make you think about what it is, what it means to us, and what we want to keep in the future.
And I believe you have mentioned that they're still not on the Endangered Species Act list. Is that correct?
Yes, there are two categories, endangered and threatened. Endangered simply means what it says. Wolverines, they are listed as threatened, which means they are threatened with becoming endangered, really. Slightly better than endangered, but they're in trouble. And recognizing that means that the federal government on federal lands will try to manage those lands to increase the population and secure the habitat a larger population would need so that it doesn't continue to decline and then slip into endangered status and then vanish. Legal trapping has seriously depleted the population of wolverines in southern British Columbia and Alberta, joining our part of the Rockies, where we used to count on wolverines dispersing from the north to replenish the U.S. population. That is looking less and less possible.
How does the future of wolverines, how is it tied directly to the idea that you call freedom to roam, that is about this growing need to establish corridors between wildlife preserves?
Well, again, wolverines are an indicator that stands out because they are at low numbers and in desperate need of connections. But I mean, all species need their populations to be connected. Genes have to flow from one subpopulation to the next. They have to do it to prevent inbreeding. It has to happen so that animals can move and adjust to changing climates. Most of the extinctions since 1500 that have been recorded, this year 1500, have taken place on oceanic islands, because they're small, isolated, and therefore vulnerable. let's go back to the wolverines in Glacier Park, or maybe 35 of them. If they don't have contact with other wolverine populations or exchange members, you're just setting it up for inbreeding. And for, again, whatever happens in Glacier Park. But with connections, you can form what we call a metapopulation in biology, where you've got subpopulations here and there that won't make it on their own. If they're connected, it can function as a single population over a large area. Elk need that, moose need that, lynx need that, wolves need that. I mean, that's just how nature works. It has to be a dynamic process with a lot of variability built in, one that allows animals to adjust to shifting conditions, because they are always shifting. That's the message from Wolverine World.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Douglas Chadwick, and that you find your way to reading The Wolverine Way, as well as visiting the website vitalground.org. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends, family, and colleagues. If you would like to share your thoughts or comments on this or any other episode, please email me at nordenpro@gmail.com. That's Norden, NOORDENPRO @gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. You can follow Nature Revisited on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and our website, nordenproductions.com. The music for Nature Revisited is Tim Buckley, Buzz and Fly. Nature Revisited is produced by Stefan Van Orden and Charles Gagan. And I hope you will join us for the next edition of Nature Revisited. And in the meantime, remember, we are nature.